Good evening and welcome to our once a month Friday evening comparative study of religions and philosophies. If you came in for the title, it's The Cross and the Tao. We might have said that incorrectly again. Not the Tao, the Tao. We have one Friday meeting a month, this one, from 7 to 8. There will be ample time for questions and discussion. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we have a lecture or a panel or a short talk. And the title for this Sunday, the 18th, is The Battles of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. On Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9, we have our study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. We're in the chapter on cycles, concluding that chapter. The reference library opens at 5:30 and stays open until 7:30. The other piece of news is, of course, our Interlodge Symposium, which will take place tomorrow. It says from 11 to 4 in the program, but it's really 11 to 4:30. It's at the National Constitution Center and is on the subject of ancient messages for modern times. And of course, the program is out there for anyone who is interested. The work of this lodge and any and every lodge, wherever in the world it is situated, including Haiti, which is up and running again, amazingly, is on the basis of one and the same declaration, the policy of the United Lodge. It is a statement of universal principles that each lodge and each individual adheres to. Every lodge is autonomous and independent, and every soul involved or interested in it is the same, independent and autonomous. There are no restrictions as to gender or color or creed or background. There are no obligations assumed except what the individual decides. It is an opportunity to study the wisdom religion and to grow in the realization of universal brotherhood. And that's why we meet twice a week and once a month, and we have symposiums and forums off-site to introduce the public to these ideas. Now, tonight, we'll start with the subject of the cross and then go right into the subject of the Tao. There are those who would very definitely say that it won't be easy to show the cross as a spiritual symbol going backwards in time in ancient ideas, because everybody knows it's a Christian symbol and therefore is only a few thousand years old. But with just a little bit of study, and not just in theosophy, we come to realize that it is far older than we could ever have even imagined. The cross is ancient. If we go to the secret doctrine in the proem, right in the very beginning, we are given a page of glyphs and symbols. It begins with a circle. The circle is then has a point in the center, and the beginning of manifested life. And then the point becomes a line, a diameter. And it says, the circle with a diameter represents divine nature within absolute infinitude. And that is followed then by a cross within the circle. And the cross within the circle represents the beginning of human life. When the circle disappears, the cross in space represents the fourth human race, the Atlanteans. So the most archaic symbols in Eastern esotericism are a circle, a cube, which is a cross when you unfold it, a point and a triangle, and these are ancient ideas. Every nation has these symbols embedded either in their physical representations or in their texts. We would like to read something that you may think is from a theosophical publication, but it isn't. It's from a newspaper in Scotland in 1870 called the Edinburgh Review. From the dawn of organized paganism in the Eastern world, the cross was one of the commonest and most sacred, and is found on the ruined walls of temples and palaces, on natural rocks, on the hoariest monoliths and the rudest statuary, on coins, medals, and vases of every description. And in not a few instances, crosses are preserved in the architectural proportions of subterranean as well as superterranean structures. And this continues in this paper. Endeavors made by people as intellectually distinct as they were geographically distinct. In other words, people who could never have communicated with each other. And the article continues. The cross meant in India, China, and Scandinavia, heaven and immortality. In Egypt, Assyria, and Britain, it was emblematical of creative power and eternity. In the two Americas, rejuvenescence and freedom from physical suffering. But in both hemispheres, it was the common symbol of resurrection or the sign of life to come. In all heathen communities, without exception, it was the emphatic type, the sole enduring evidence of divine unity. No fact is better established than the reverence shown to the cross in all the ages prior to Christianity. It sounds like a theosophist wrote that, doesn't it? So we find it venerated in pre-Christian times on both sides of the Atlantic, in all of the pagan and Indian and Buddhist and as well as the earlier cultures. The X, we can never say this correctly for sure, decussated cross is the X. It was used by the Hindus and the Buddhists thousands of years before it showed up in Europe. And an interesting Hindu tradition, when a Hindu wanted to worship Agni, the god of fire, they would lay two pieces of wood down as a cross, and then by a strange whirling and friction, they would create fire for the sacrifice for the god of fire in the shape of a cross. Perhaps we don't realize that the pyramids stand square with the points of the compass. Now, a pyramid we all think of as triangles, but it isn't. It's a square. It's a cross. And it stands square with the points of the compass. All of them do, wherever in the world. It has been found that many of the older solar temples of Egypt faced the sunrise or sunset at the time of the summer solstice. In Bullfinch's mythology, he asks a wonderful question. Again, this is not a theosophical writing. Is it possible to suppose all these extraordinary coincidences to be the result of accident? We might just as well say that the similarities between the American and the English forms of government were not the result of relationship or descent, but that men placed in similar circumstances spontaneously reached the same results. obviously the conclusion is that there was knowledge, and that knowledge was universal. But perhaps the most, I don't know, sad, amusing, interesting thing for those of us here in the Americas is that when the Spanish missionaries arrived in South America in the 15th century, everywhere they turned, they found crosses. And they realized that the Indian population venerated the cross as a symbol as much as they did. And they didn't know what to make of it. It was on buildings, in artwork, on sculpture, statuary. It challenged them. So, you know what they said? It must have been the devil putting it there before Christianity, so to tax the faithful when they came along. And that was their answer. In Mexico itself, Cortez wrote a letter to King Charles V saying that in one area alone, Cholula, he counted 400 pyramids. Just as an aside, we may think that the pyramids of Mexico are not as significant, perhaps, but they are, again, gigantic crosses pointing in a particular direction. And if we take the Great Pyramid of Egypt, it's certainly taller than anything in Mexico, but Cheops is 746 feet square and covers 12 to 13 acres. That's big, right? The Great Pyramid of Cholula is 1,400 feet square, twice as big, and covers 45 acres. Such exact measurements of compass points that they were able to carry out. But it's just a way of reminding us that ancient worship was never primitive. It goes back to the third race. The Lemurians had no religion. They didn't have to rely on faith for anything. They knew themselves as one with their divine instructors, and they knew themselves as one with the all, with the great spiritual sun. And that worship was reflected in the cross, the sign of man in incarnation as a spiritual being. So now we'll hear how the Tao descended from them.
Well, it's amazing because you hear about with the chicken, which came first, the chicken or the egg, and sometimes it seems like, well, which came first? The cross or the Tao, or the Tao or the cross. But they're it's interesting because they both cross, well, I'm using it as a verb, mm-hmm. that it crosses, you know, boundary lines, because the cross in all of its forms has been a common symbol for thousands of years, and as was said, it's found in all cultures, all types of people, ancient Egyptians and before, up through and including Christians of today, the New Age movement and beyond. But we do know that the Tau is the 19th letter of the Greek alphabet, and it was the sign of the Greek god Attis, the Roman god Mithras, and the Druid god Hu, H-U. And as we said, it's an ancient symbol of every ancient peoples noted in history. And of course, we all know, if we just take the little circle here, that it's shaped like a T. And normally, the top and the vertical piece are usually of the same, this equal length. It was first recorded in Ezekiel 9:4. Quote, go through the city of Jerusalem and mark a Tau on the foreheads of those who grieve and lament over all the detestable things that are done in it, meaning in Jerusalem. And it was done to distinguish the faithful from those who practiced paganism. And it was also inscribed on the forehead of every person who was admitted into the mysteries of Mithras. And when a king was initiated in Egypt into the mysteries, the Tau was put over his lips. And it was also marked on a person's forehead when they had been pardoned by the king for crimes that they supposedly had committed. And it's been used to, along with the swastika, to mark sacred water jars. And it is associated with the idea of water. And also it's a widespread and ancient symbol of the sun god. And in Egyptian culture and architecture, it's just all over. There's, along with the cross, there's just, you know, these symbols are noted everywhere. And when the tiles are joined together horizontally, they represent a temple. And just like it's mentioned here, the henges in Britain, like an example was Stonehenge. And when the tiles are joined together in a circular fashion, they're designed to form a temple. And it's also called a tav, T-A-V, although we've never seen it anywhere pronounced that way, but it is also called a tav. And St. Francis of Assisi has used it as his emblem. And apparently he was introduced to it while he was working with the lepers. St. Anthony the Hermit, who was working with him, they used it to protect themselves from the plague and other skin diseases. And he finally did use it and take it unto himself as his own crest and signature. And it says, for him, the T represented lifelong fidelity to the passion of Christ. It was his pledge to serve the least, the leper, and the outcast of his day. And Pope Innocent III also used it, and he took it from the prophet Ezekiel as well. Further on, it says, we are called to reform our lives, to stand in the presence of God as righteous people. God will know us by the sign of the Tau marked on our foreheads. And St. Francis took that literally, and he's as he put it, knowing that the best documents and decrees from above go unnoticed, they are translated into good deeds in the streets below. St. Francis stretched out his arms and proclaimed to his friars that their religious habit or tunic was the Tau cross. So as the Christian era expanded and the Egyptian era began to fade, the sign of the Tau was adapted by the Coptic Church as their unique form, and they called it the Crux Ansata, we think we're pronouncing it right, mm-hmm. Otherwise known as the Ankh. So the Ankh is a form of the Tau, and what it is, it's as can see by my little necklace, it is topped by a circle, and it's also called the cross of life. And it was the key to the mysteries of antiquity as a candidate passed through all forms of actual and imaginary dangers. He would hold the Ankh above his head for protection against these dark forces. And the Ankh is seen in many ancient beliefs as well, emblem of the water gods, heaven, immortality, rejuvenation, and freedom from suffering. And it also is associated with water. The Egyptians would use it to measure the Nile River, because the Nile would frequently overflow, and they somehow fashioned the Ankh in such a way that they could check the water level of the Nile and to see if it was on its way up to overflowing. And in papyrus scrolls, it is noted that the Ankhs were shown to come out of the king's mouth when they were giving a person, when they were, pardoning someone. Just like the person with the towel would put the towel, if they were pardoned, the king was given the Ankh when they pardoned somebody. And they also were buried with it to signify the immortality of the soul. And many gods and goddesses would carry it by the loop to show their divine natures and life-giving powers. The Gnostics and the Copts used the symbolic representation of both physical and eternal life. The loop symbolizes the sun on the horizon and stands for the sun, heaven, and earth as the macrocosm, with man on the cross as the microcosm. And the Ankh symbol is also used in astrology to represent the planet Venus. In alchemy, it represents the element copper. And in biology, it identifies the female sex. And it is also seen as an integration of the pairs of opposites that we often speak of in theosophy. And the Ankh was also, this. We thought this was just like an interesting little tidbit. The Ankh, the word Ankh was also used for mirror. Because and many mirrors were shaped as Ankh. Since life and death mirror each other, mirrors were used for the purpose of divinations. And we just had a couple quotes that we wanted to read. The loop is the perfect symbol of what has neither beginning nor end and stands for the soul, which is eternal, because it has sprung from the spirit essence of the gods. Furthermore, the Ankh symbolized the spring from which flow divine virtues and the elixir of immortality. Therefore, to hold the Ankh was to drink from that well. The Ankh is placed on the forehead between the eyes, and then it symbolizes the duty of the adept to keep secret the mystery into which he had been initiated. And the Ankh is often set in the same category as the, and this is in parenthesis, I mean in italics, the girdle of Isis as a symbol of eternity. This is because its straight lines, it's not because its straight lines may be lengthened to the imagination to infinity, but because they converge upon and meet in a closed loop. This loop symbolizes the inexhaustible essence of the life force. Hence, the Ankh may be identified with the tree of life. And we were also going to bring up the part in the secret doctrine that was already presented about the circle with the line. And it's interesting because in that respect, when you have the circle with just the horizontal line, and you can see the progression as man falls into matter, the progression of the crosses, because it's the circle with the line across, and then it comes this way, and then the cross disappears. I mean, the circle disappears, then you have the full cross indicating
human life,
the separation of the sexes. Yeah. So that was it. If anybody has any questions. Yes. Yes.
Is there any difference between the cross that's centered and the cross that the Christians generally use, which is the crucifix, which is, you know, not centered, the horizontal bar is...
As far as we know, no, it's just the tradition of the way they depict it. But perhaps that was actually the way it was done in Roman times to crucify criminals, that was the shape of the cross that was used. But the cross for many, many, many years never had a crucified Christ on it. That was a later thing. Although in one of the Americas, There is that X cross, and it's done on like a hill. And if you look at it, you see a cross. Then you look again, no, it's not a cross, it's a man. And then it looks like a cross again. So it is a man on a cross, but you can't tell the one from the other. And that's, they say, is very ancient.
Yeah, and we think the shape of the cross where it's longer, as in the question that was just asked, we just think that that was a practical way that they had to make the cross in order to crucify somebody.
You had your hand.
Both presentations have the idea that the cross could be found on the forehead.
No, not both. That was the top.
Oh, that didn't come up in the first one? Mm-hmm. Okay. It reminded us of, in the Christian faith, the ashes usually are given
Ash Wednesday.
In the cross form.
And they do make a cross, don't they, when they do it?
And we think that that has to do with the idea of differentiating between those that, not divine, but those that believe and those that are the pagans. We think it probably goes back to that, from the Ezekiel quote.
HPB does say somewhere in the Secret Doctrine that some people are born with a karmic seal on their forehead that points to some either initiation or ancient learning. Yes?
About the cross that is not an exact square, it's an unfolded cube, which
yes.
is very interesting
yes.
because you've got four, and then the one center one with one on
right, and there's side. A great footnote in the Secret Doctrine on the unfolded cube.
And the Hindu Vitoba.
What?
The Hindu Vitoba is a very, very interesting figure for Christians because it is the man crucified in space down to the nail marks. On the hands
W-I-T-O-B-A.
And what's interesting about that, of course, is you've got a triangle, and when the feet separate, you've got a square.
W-I-T-O-B-A?
There may be two T's.
Two T's.
I'm not sure. In the New York Library, we have a picture of that, the Hindu Vitoba.
Wow.
And it is pre-Christian.
Oh. Well, that must confound them, the way South America confounds them. Yes?
You find it spelled V-I-T-O-B-A.
Okay. Thank you.
We think we remember hearing in studying a little bit with the Egyptian pyramids and whatnot that the initiation chambers might have had a cross-shaped sarcophagus or something similar to it where the aspirant, the soon-to-be initiate, would assume that position during the initiation.
I think it says he was tied down.
To a cross.
And I think it's 3 days, and then the light comes through, strikes them in the eyes. If they wake up, they were successful. If not, they were not. It's interesting to think about. We have no idea what we might have gone through in Egypt. Of course, a failure is never a failure, because you learn something that you need to know to be successful. Yes. And we are those Egyptians. But we've never heard of Cholula before. 400 pyramids.
That's incredible.
It's amazing. Yes?
Just as a visual, the 13 acres... The smaller period, which was 13 acres,
of Cheops.
Penn's Landing is 13 acres.
Really?
Yes, so if you can imagine that, it's pretty big.
Yeah, it built up. Yeah.
What is?
Cheops, the Great Pyramid.
Penn's Landing. On the Delaware.
Which is really a very spiritual place because it's where William Penn and the Lenape Indians. Is that the group?
Yeah, the Lenape or Lenape, They called themselves UNAMI, UNAMI. That's what they called themselves.
Will you continue saying what took place there?
That was the second landing of Williamtown. He landed in Chester first.
Mistake, and then he went to
Bangor. He came up river.
Right.
He actually was going to build his city in Chester, which was called Upland at the time. But after just a couple of months, he figured out that really, with the confluence of the two rivers,
right,
and it was better strategically, so he decided to found Philadelphia where it is today.
But he signed a treaty, didn't he, with...
That was in Shackamaxon. He signed the treaty in Shackamaxon with Tanaman, which Tammany Hall is named after in New York City.
But Tanaman is an Indian group?
Chief. Mm-hmm. He was the chief of the five tribes.
Okay.
And but that's kind of...
Evidently, funny. Penn did far more to be fair and honorable with the natives that were here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
It's funny, we're looking around the room at the architecture, and the Tao is one of the probably most used supportive structures, the intersection for support, and yet being able to put more on top of that because of the vertical piece as well. We were thinking in nature, the way a tree grows and the way some plants or flowers do, it's up and then it's usually out, almost like the arms coming out to the side.
So but there is something more to be said about that. We're taught that 10 is the perfect number, but that's all there is. You just described a tree going up straight and then going, well, this arc is a part of a circle. Everywhere you look, that's all you're going to see ever is a 1 and a 0. Everything. The human body, everything man-made, everything nature-made. That's why we find it hard to believe that people ever thought the earth was flat when everything they see in the sky is round. It doesn't make any sense. But I guess if you think you're special, then you're that mm-hmm. different. Yes?
It was only a small number.
That thought that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's true. And they were afraid to think, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah,
be penalized.
Yeah.
Perhaps they thought by putting that misinformation out that the earth was flat, that people couldn't stray beyond certain boundaries. Just as the church, you couldn't ask certain questions. You had to swallow all their dogmas. So perhaps that was part of the thinking. You know, it's fear. You'll fall off the edge of the earth.
Yeah, keep them dumb is another way of saying it. Yes.
That's why they didn't teach them how to read.
Yes.
Reading is power.
I'm just thinking, aren't these both symbols of universal equanimity? In the case of the cross, if it's equal length on both sides, you've got perfect balance. In the case of the Tao, you've got the fulcrum directly in the middle to again make the triangles, but to mm-hmm. give equal balance. So we're surrounded by symbols of what mm-hmm. we are seeking at all times, which is that harmony, that balance.
And the Ankh with the circle, we're looking at the perfect number 10 mm-hmm. again as well.
An evolution.
Yes.
Now, is it the swastika like a variation on the cross?
On the cross,
yeah, the
yes.
twisted cross. We
think. Yeah, it's got feet. Why? Why would a cross have feet? Yes.
It depicts motion.
Yes, it indicates motion, evolution, growth, progress. The swastika is a symbol of life in motion.
And when it was put with the Tao on the, we were trying to understand why the swastika and the Tao were put on the sacred water jugs. And we wonder, with the idea of motion, then water is in motion. I mean, when you really think about it. So we wondered if it has something to do with that, but we couldn't find why that was so.
Good. It's always nice to have a challenge, isn't it? We think that's the real benefit of these Friday night meetings, mm-hmm. because if you're required to speak about it, you have to learn something about it. And it becomes a real challenge.
Or get comfortable in saying that you don't know why.
Right. Oh, we do that well. Yes.
One of the interesting things about the about symbols such as that is the cycles that they come in, you know, how they turn from one thing to another, how they mean something, and in a couple of years or a couple of centuries, they mean exactly the opposite. We were all present at the last meeting we had, and someone saw the swastika, and it was, they couldn't get that out of their mind. During the 60s, among a lot of the black nationalists, the cross became the symbol of death.
The black what?
Black nationalists.
I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah, it became a symbol of death. And the reasoning was, that's what you see in the graveyards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
So it became a symbol of death. So these symbols, they have their cycles that they come when they're one thing, and then you look around and they mean something entirely different.
But only to the people of that time, not to the ones who created the symbol and who hold the esoteric meaning behind it.
We always have to have some smart people, or else we're lost forever.
Yes, and, it's a good
and
thing.
And Dort, when the New Age era was so vibrant, well, we guess it was in what, the 70s and the 80s or something, mm. That the Ankh, that was like the calling card.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody knew what the Ankh was back then. Back in the day. Yes.
We don't know if we read it or heard it. We know we heard someone say it and it resonated with us. God geometrizes.
Mm-hmm. Plato said it, I think.
Thank you.
I think so.
Yeah, there is, for those of us who are math challenged, it is quite fun to, with ideas like this, look at all of these symbols all around us. Just the study of this room would be a lifetime, right. But it's the reminder that the symbols hold all the wisdom that we have inside, and it's the awakenings, the gradual awakenings that we have.
Two things. One, keep that in mind tomorrow, because that's what you're going to be hearing about symbols that have been made manifest and for a reason. That's what we all have to figure out. What is the reason this is there for us to see? And the other thing, HPB says an amazing thing in The Secret Doctrine, and we know personally, as soon as we read it, we flew to get a copy of Vitruvius. She says that the work of Vitruvius, a mathematician, architect, we think, has absolutely the entire esoteric secret doctrine contained within it. But if you can understand one sentence of it, it's all mathematical. It's all, not even geometry. To me, it's more like algebra. Yes.
Well, didn't the Masons in the medieval times mm-hmm. put all those symbols in the cathedrals? They had that knowledge and they wanted to preserve it, and they put it in the cathedrals.
Well, that's what you'll discover mm-hmm. tomorrow. That's yeah. what they did with Angkor Wat and yeah. Stonehenge and the pyramids, and it was all of it was to carry the wisdom forward.
We recently read, speaking of geometry and nature, we recently read an article about snowflakes, because everybody says that there's no two snowflakes alike. Well, the reasoning behind that, it has to do with the temperature of the air, the temperature of the rain, the water, and then if there's dust particles. We didn't know this. Snowflakes are built around dust particles. And it has to do with what the dust particles are made of. Mm-hmm. And then when the water attaches to it, it crystallizes in different ways, depending upon how much water is in the air and the temperature. And it was just the most amazing thing. We had no idea. But it was all crystals and all different shapes. And, you know, the geometry of nature is just phenomenal.
So snow is a pearl. Like in an oyster, It comes from an irritation. Mm-hmm. Oh, nice. Now I wish it would snow so we could go out and look at it.
Go check out
all
There is a wonderful book that's just been written by a female scientist. She's a nature scientist. And I'm sorry, we don't remember the name of it. We read the review. She is trying to introduce all of these various practitioners in various fields, from engineers and architects and educators, to duplicate nature. Because nature does not kill itself to do anything. It has a very orderly, efficient method for making things. And she's trying to teach everyone, just imitate nature. Don't go to all this expense and drama. And we read in the National Geographic yesterday about a new water system designed by the Swiss. And we want to mention it just because nature, and it's so wonderful. You take plastic water bottles and you clean all the labels off. You go to the murkiest pond in the neighborhood and fill the water bottles. And then you lay them on metal in open sunlight. And in 6 hours, the ultraviolet rays will kill all the viruses, the bacteria, the parasites. At schools in Africa where they're doing this on the corrugated roofs and the water sits there for 6 hours in the sun, the children have benefited in their health some 80%, and their grades, because they're no longer brain fogged with things, their grades have gone up 80%, and it's free.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the things that hinders that idea of doing everything like nature, because of there's no waste in our present system, there would be no profit. And since this is a profit-driven era that we're in, many things that could have been done to alleviate suffering and uplift people had to be abandoned because of our major concern, which is profit. Last week on the pyramid codes that was brought forth about energy and the idea of at one time that Tesla had a formula that would have given free energy to everyone. J.P. Morgan said there's no profit in it. That idea was abandoned and Tesla was left to the dust heap of history.
Well, we think the electric car initially, when it first came out, It was, you know, cut off as well because it wouldn't make a profit.
There was a gentleman a number of years ago intrigued by the birds and the seals that were coated with oil when there'd be an oil spill. And I mean, coated to the point where they would die. And he was intrigued by it and kept studying it. And then he went around to all the barber shops and beauty shops. And he collected all the hair that was cut every day. And he created this barrier thing full of hair. And they purposely spilled the oil. He threw down the hair thing. There was no oil on the water. It was all in this barrier that he had created. Now, that would be free except for the netting, because human hair is always being cut. And they destroyed the idea. It's never been allowed to be produced. But the very fact that we can do that as human beings, put profit before people or anything, also proves that we could do the opposite once we decide. Yes?
Right, because the deficiency isn't in our technology. There have been plenty of studies that said we actually could feed the world. We actually could grow enough to feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the deficiency lies in our will.
Right.
We don't have the will.
Well, in our desire.
Our desire
is mostly selfish. But then, isn't that what we, as students of this philosophy, isn't that why we're the companions to the masters? They can't be here pointing to all of this wisdom, but we are. And we're supposed to be doing it. We're supposed to be changing the world around us little by little. Yes?
So what is the symbolism of the crucifixion?
Have you ever read Through the Gates of Gold? There's some amazing statements in there about what a horrible, hideous thing it is. And to have that depiction, even in our minds, is not a worthy thing. When we think of crucifixion, philosophy tells us we are crucifying the higher nature by those very choices and desires of selfishness and not caring about humanity. So that's the real crucifixion. The crucifixion of the Christ is to allow people to believe the sins that you haven't even committed yet have been paid for by the death of this one individual. It really makes no sense.
We have time for a few more.
I guess.
Yes.
So is there a correspondence then if we read in that religion that Christ died and rose again in 3 days? Is that symbolic of the death of the lower or personal self? Certainly not in the case of the Christ symbol, but could we correspond that with the death of the lower and the resurrection being the awakening to the higher within us, a conscious awakening? Might that be the kind of resurrection that we're talking about?
We had always been under the impression that indeed that's what that meant, was that it was the death of the higher on the crucifixion, on the cross, as was just stated, and that the resurrection was about how a person would, we can't even put it into
reborn.
Words. Reborn,
right.
Thank you.
Born
was
in the higher
reborn
nature.
Into their higher nature.
But it has so many,
yeah.
many possible mm-hmm. explanations. Go ahead.
Well, one of them, and I'm not really, I'm only remembering the generalities of this. This is a time of nature of the year when the sun dips below the horizon for 3 days. And Jesus, the sun, S-O-N, or S-U-N of God, that's supposed to be the symbol.
Well, that's in the winter solstice.
Right.
It is said that the sun gods enter the lowest, the hell.
3 days.
In 3 days in hell. And then when they rise from that, they bring all of that elevation up with them.
Right.
But there's even more symbology there. Yes.
Yes, I'm trying to remember the article. It may be the roots of ritualism in church and masonry. But HPB explains that the biblical story we have was based upon the rites of initiation.
In the pyramid.
She says literally twisted out of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it you've already described. The candidate was tied.
Right.
Not nailed. Tied. To a cross, plunged into a trance.
For 3 days and three nights.
3 days, at which time he supposedly descended into the lower regions to do works of service
mm-hmm.
for whatever is there, and then was carried to a point where the rays of the rising sun struck him and he awoke the
An
new
initiate. Yeah.
But to say that someone had descended into hell for 3 days was equivalent to saying they had gone through this ancient process.
Initiation.
Of initiation.
Right. Yeah, so there's many, many descriptions of it. But it's all tied in with the equinoxes and the solstices. I mean, we have good reason to celebrate those things, because they are a part of our own spiritual heritage. Yes?
What we always thought that there was an astronomical component to the three-day allegory, that during the equinoxes there's 3 days when there's no movement.
Well, isn't that what he said? The sun moves backwards or down.
So there's like a three-day period of no movement in the solstice and the equinox. So that is the three-day period that we keep on seeing reference made to.
Yeah, it should be a very special time for humanity. And it's turned into parties and spending money. Not this year so much, though. People couldn't do it, so maybe they found some spiritual value in it. Yes?
Well, we were wondering if it was stated, I'm sure it was, that the cross itself is when you get up in the morning and the sun's coming up, you look over the horizon and you see the horizontal line.
No, it wasn't. That's very
and
nice.
And the sun comes up
and makes
you see the vertical line.
Yeah.
You actually see that cross.
Oh, that's very nice.
Each morning, and that's where we thought that it probably originated.
Of course, you couldn't live in a city and see that. see buildings.
That's really interesting because it goes through all three of them, all three that we talked about. You know, it starts out with the horizontal and the sun coming up, so that we have the Tao, the sun coming up this way, and then it comes up and it's the Ankh,
right.
And then it goes up again, and then it's the cross. So it's interesting
that's
how
very
you
nice.
Have all three of them. Yes.
Does the sun come up?
No.
The earth goes down.
Yeah, we do something.
Now the earth goes down.
We use words because we can't understand things. So we have to keep explaining things to ourselves. And we recall we were standing in the Independence Hall, and the guide was giving a lecture, and he pointed to the ceiling, and he said, the wall, and he said, now it isn't known, and wasn't known at the time they were arguing about the Declaration, is that a rising sun or a setting sun? We thought, how funny. It isn't either. It's we who rise and set. The sun is steady. Yes?
Exactly, but that's the symbolism, the rising up as the soul rises. And we're always amazed that in Spanish, the word for sunrise, sonrisa, is the same word for smile.
Oh, that's nice. Turn your own sun on, huh? Yeah. Yeah, there's, Mr. Judge says there's so many secrets in words. If you want to, I don't know, just feel really nice, go to a Funk and Wagnalls dictionary. Is it Funk and Wagnalls or Wagner?
I contributed to it.
And Mr. Judge is in there. He is one of the contributors for the Theosophical terms, and he still has his name in there. Yes.
One of the interesting depictions of Christ on the cross was the one by Salvador Dali, because the cross that he has Christ on is the even cross. But the interesting thing about it, the sections, and there's five sections, one in the middle, one on each side, they're cubes, perfect cubes. They look like they might be metal, but they're perfect cubes. And the figure is stretched in the usual way, but it's on these cubes. Now that you have brought this up, I have to go back and see if he had some planned symbolism in that, because that was his, that was his forte, the symbolism. It's probably got a lot of hidden stuff in it.
I was thrown out of the Art Institute in Chicago because my 4-year-old son touched the Goya to see if the blood was real. It was the crucifixion of Christ. It's the most amazing painting, we think, of the crucifixion. You feel like you're there, and you wonder how people do this every year and ponder this and think about this. This is the year of the Passion Play, too. In Oberammergau, every 10 years, the entire town turns out, and they don't even know who's going to play Jesus, and they act the whole Passion. It's very sad.
But we wonder, you know, theosophically, we look at all these hidden ideas that are in the Bible and in all these symbols, and if one tries to explain it, because we remember we went to a Catholic college, and incredibly, one of the priest who was the pastor at the college taught the symbolism of the Bible. And we started on the Old Testament, and we were just amazed that he was actually teaching. To me, it was like almost like blasphemy. But most people just won't or can't believe, because it's things that they've never heard before, what these hidden meanings are in so many of these symbols. And tomorrow is just going to be an incredible day. Because
we hope.
It will. It will be an incredible day to find all these hidden meanings in all these buildings and structures.
Well, we do know one thing. It is a concerted effort of three lodges, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yes?
Just thinking in the iconic history of Hollywood, if we take the vampire as representative of evil, the thing that would stop him cold was a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to work only if the one holding it believed in its power.
Hmm.
If not, then it was ineffective.
Hmm.
Interesting.
We think HPB does write in some places about vampires and werewolves and the actuality of such phenomena. Yes.
In the early church, they had a brazen cross.
I don't know what that is.
It was made out of brass.
Oh, that's what brazen means?
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was supposedly had a power that when touched would erase evil.
Well, do you think it was the brass or the fact that the one who made it gave it magnetism, or?
Well, we think it was the fact that it was brass, which is a combination of what, tin and copper?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. It's a wonder that you don't see that in magazines and things, you know? You see a lot of snake oil stuff. Why not something real?
Yes.
You did get a touch of it, but it was just a copper.
Just
supposed to wear the copper bracelets for.
Oh, that's right.
The flower was a big deal with that.
But whether it's the faith that the person puts in it, we do know that some people have gotten arthritic relief from copper.
Just thinking, is it called the caduceus, we think?
Yes, the two snakes on the...
Wrapped around.
Yeah, wrapped around a T.
Anything there?
Well, it's fascinating. Snakes are a symbol for it's a life-giving symbol, because they live under the ground, they live in the water, and then they come up. But they are, it's a life-giving symbol, and wrapped around the symbol for life, the town. So we don't know why there's two of them, though. Why there would be two. Yes.
Could it be magnetism and electricity?
Right.
Oh.
Pingala and...
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we really are out of time.
Yes.
And polish up all your questions.
Yes, for tomorrow.
And use them tomorrow.
Yes.
Meeting is adjourned. This is what you...